life, universe, and everything. So settle in, get comfortable, and let our journey begin as we meet the hosts, internationally acclaimed mediums, Nick and Sylvie Avery.
Well, hello, I'm Sylvie Avery, and welcome to Spirits Work, the show that's designed to stretch your mind and broaden your understanding about life on Earth, life after death, and life in other dimensions. In the most natural way, we are able to cross the divide between our physical world and the non-physical world when my husband Nick deep trance channels an enlightened spirit called Gregory Hay, who has access to great knowledge and wisdom. And this week's show is going to be our listeners' questions and whatever it is as well that Spirit Gregory wants to talk to us about to kick us off. And if you have anything that you would like to join us with, either relating to a subject that we're talking about or a new discussion, it's general discussions, it's not a readings type situation, but it's anything that you ever wanted to know from the spirit world but never knew who to ask, the phone lines will be open. And that's toll-free in the US, it's 877-876-5227. In Canada, it's 888-815-9756. And international callers, it's not toll-free, but the number is 001-530-876-3222.
Well, hi, I'm Nick Avery. As well as Spirit's Work on bbsradio.com, every Sunday at 10 a.m. PST, 1 p.m. EST, 6 p.m. GMT, we have another radio show, and that's called Spirit Teaching. And you can hear that on artistfirst.com every Tuesday at 4 p.m. PST, that's 7 p.m. EST, and midnight UK. If you would like to know more about us, our book CDs, book and Akashic reading, we suggest you go visit our website, which is at www.spirit-teaching.com, and also live at www.spiritsworkradio.com. What we're able to do as spirit mediums is to offer you the spirit world's perspective on the nature of our existence. And when I go into the deep trance state, Gregory Hay, who is the spokesperson for an educational group in the spirit world called the White Cloud Group, will borrow my body for the whole of the show. I will not know of anything else that happens during the time of the show because my spirit and my consciousness are transported to somewhere else. Please do look at our website for a better understanding of how we work because we haven't got too much time to go through all of the information at the beginning of each and every single show, because it really would take up way too much valuable time. So I'm going to say goodbye for this week, and it's hopefully only going to take a few seconds or so for Gregory, for the spirit world, to take charge of my physical body and for me to let go of it. Well, hope so, anyway.
Kicking and screaming now.
Kicking and screaming, yes. No, actually, it'll just be lights out, hopefully.
Yeah. Okay, well, Gregory had an earth life 300 years ago, but has continued to learn and evolve in the spirit world, and this is how he can come back to share his wisdom with us for our benefit. The White Cloud Group, whom he represents, were formed to bring us knowledge that will hopefully steer us toward a more peaceful and harmonious future. We are made up of all kinds of scientific minds and scholars from all walks of life, as well as ordinary people who have a valuable input to make. The information we bring is without religious bias or political persuasion, and we believe in everyone's right to their own views and beliefs. If you would like us to ask some questions on the show, or even compile a show around some questions if you have enough of them one week, then you can email me at enq@spirit-teaching.com anytime, and I will put you in our file, and I promise you I will get round to asking Gregory on air. Sometimes people prefer to do that because maybe they actually listen to this show on the archive and can't make it on the actual day or whatever. So this is your chance to do just that. So make it general. Like I say, we discuss everything we've been programmed to believe and hopefully emerge with a fresh point of view that is more applicable to life now, basically. So we do Akashic readings, one-to-one Akashic readings, if that's what you want. And you can have a one-to-one with Gregory on the telephone or in person if you are in the UK, because that's where we are at the moment. You can find out more about that on our website, www.spirit-teaching.com as well. They really are quite different. So take a little look around and do get in touch, and I will help you if you have any questions. I will get back to you straight away. Well, Gregory's here now. Hello, Gregory.
It's love and light. Blessings be upon your pathway, my dear friend, little bird. Hello.
Hi, thank you.
And love and blessings to Don Newsom and to his brother Doug, and also to many of the other little Newsoms we know and are aware of in the Newsom household, as long with his lovely wife, of course. So many blessings to all of you. Yeah.
Well, thank you for that. Okay, well, how would you like to begin today? Basically, last week we were talking about bacteria and that sort of thing, and we didn't actually touch on the swine flu thing. So, because it's so topical at the moment, I know probably a lot of people are fed up with listening about it as well. But nevertheless, it's either going to affect us or somebody that we know at some point.
Yes.
So, what does the spirit world have to say on it?
Well, I understand, my dear friend, there are some people who think that it has been created on purpose or something like that. And the point is that these kinds of changes in virus, like the influenza virus, are quite normal. They're not rare. They're simple mutations that occur in the presence of physical life, whereby any kind of mutation can take place. It's exactly what many forms of cancer are. They're simply mutations of cells. In many respects, you are looking at the reordination of one group of cells, which then begin as viruses, which then begin to mutate into a different form. There have been many different forms of influenza, I understand, throughout the centuries, and particularly within the last 100 years or so. In fact, there have been many different kinds of influenza. So it is not abnormal for one to be moving around the planet at this present time. Perhaps it may well be that human beings' movements are, in a sense, exacerbating it, helping it to spread from one place to another place. It is oftentimes something which is airborne, so it means it's indiscriminate. In this respect, then, it may well be that the airborne side of it is merely passed on people's clothing or objects or something like that. The virus itself doesn't know it is a threat to human beings. It doesn't know anything. The virus itself has no mindful knowledge of what it is. Therefore, its only interpretation of life is to continue to thrive in the best kind of habitat it can possibly experience and find for itself. And that is why it is that initiates sneezing and coughing and that kind of thing, in order that it may then be able to spread to other hosts and take part in that kind of situation, because it wants to replicate itself. That's not a conscious physical effort. It's not something that one has to understand in fully consciousness of a decision-making process. It can be instinctive purely and simply when single-celled or multi-celled but simple beings are able to mutate and continue to grow in abundance. It's simply a genetic marker that allows that virus or cell, whatever it is, to populate the physical world. That's exactly the same as different kinds of spiragyra. It's exactly the same as different other kinds of multiple cell but simple beings that have physical life. You might look at all kinds of fungus, many different kinds of bacteria, some of which we talked about last time, which are both useful and harmful as well, depending on their environment and the way that they grow. Doesn't necessarily mean to say that they are all harmful. It's just that for some human beings, their reaction to them can become harmful. So this is part of the reason why you have at this present time with swine flu, influenza, that what is happening is there are natural subtleties, particularly to do with women who are pregnant, that kind of situation. And that is simply and purely because the dominant situation in most human beings is suppressed in women who are pregnant, which is to kill or to annihilate or attack whatever appears to be a threat to the physical body system. The simple thing that happens in pregnant women or very young children is that their autoimmune system has been depressed, suppressed because of the pregnancy. That's what pregnancy does. It suppresses the autoimmune system so that the physical body of the host, mother, does not eat or ingest the child as a otherwise sometimes fatal situation that may well occur. And that's simply because the physical body or parts of the physical body may not necessarily know or be aware that this is actually meant to be, but just simply for some people, for example, if they have a particularly strong genetics in one particular way, that the cell orientation of white cell activity, for example, or some such thing, simply thinks that the fetus is actually an invading body and then will set about destroying it. So part then of what happens within this kind of influenza is that if the autoimmune system of the pregnant mother is suppressing, is being suppressed by the mother's own biology, if you like, the chemistry within the woman's body is actually commanding, in a sense, that the autoimmune system, almost like it depletes it. So it doesn't shut it down completely, but it does deplete it drastically so that it does not harm the fetus. And this is where the situation of pregnant women is so vital to understand. And that's part of the reason why it is that this kind of influenza may well harm women who are pregnant, so with child, so that they may perhaps not go and do the shopping or something like that, but get somebody else to do it. It's obviously much easier for them than to stay away from that kind of virus. In fact, however, if they do catch it, it's not automatically fatal, I'm not saying that. But what actually happens is that it can be quite unpleasant, I understand, and create a steep rise in temperature change, as well as issues to do with hydration that need to be kept together. So really, though, that is the only biological situation that we can see. Although we do understand that there are issues whereby the virus itself in Mexico, for example, is slightly different to that which is presently in existence, and there will come a time when it is understood and seen through a microscopic analysis that the virus is actually changing and mutating slightly as it goes into different temperature climbs, because that seems to have a difference of structure. It's part of the reason, incidentally, why it is that when the situation of a change in the environment, such as you're moving into autumn or autumnal weather and that kind of thing, is usually when the autoimmune system should actually be, in a sense, it's in a state of flux, because it's between summer and winter, and it's all about change. So it's building up itself, but not, in fact, usually strong enough to reflect, to deflect differences in viral tendencies, which then happens with this kind of influenza, that it tends to mutate as more and more it becomes established. I'm not saying that it's drastically mutated at this present time into an ultimately harmful virus, but what is happening is that it is changing gradually. So it means to say that when you have this situation of antibiotics or whatever, it's not necessarily going to suppress it. And I understand, in actual fact, point of fact, that the antibiotics themselves have a certain disadvantage, because they have side effects which can be extremely harmful to some children. That doesn't mean to say that you shouldn't take it, but it does mean that you need to be aware of what those effects are. For some people, it may well be that they allow their children to get it and move through having this kind of influenza, simply to, in a sense, make them stronger. It's part of the reason why there is this age difference, whereby many people who are at least 45 years of age and older will tend not to get it, will tend not to catch this kind of influenza, or if they do, it will be very mild, purely and simply because they've already been through two different bouts of it in a different form, most probably. As in different strains of this kind of situation happened with both Asian flu and also Spanish flu beforehand, of course, a great many years ago, as far as you're concerned, but also other bouts of influenza that have drifted across the planet. Yes. So I hope that clears some matters up.
Yes, yes. And the precautions, obviously, like staying out of public places if possible, but that's virtually impossible for most people.
Yes, quite so.
But, yes, wherever you can, in like you say, the pregnant women situation,
yes.
make exceptions for that.
And I would also suggest that if people do go out into public places, that they actually wash their hands whilst they are out, and certainly before returning, because oftentimes the things that you touch, just simple things like doorknobs, the kinds of different doorways that you go through, and all of that which is to do with that, are generally going to be where viruses like this are going to collect. So before you get them back into your vehicle or something like that, you need to wash your hands before you do that, yes.
Even pressing the button on the lift, on the elevator or whatever. I mean, you know, it's the escalator, there's all sorts of things, isn't there, really, if you think about it.
Those are moving pathways, friend.
Yes, they are, but...
I understand.
Touch it, yes. So, but where people put their hands, and everybody puts their hands.
Yes.
You have to wear little plastic gloves and throw them away. Disposable gloves when you go out. And a mask. And a suit. Space suit. Okay, calm down. All right then. So, so we shouldn't panic, really?
No. Okay. No, absolutely not.
Okay.
I understand that there are some situations where people who did not have underlying causes actually passed from this situation.
Yes, there has been.
Yes. However, the condition means that for themselves, there still must have been an underlying cause or a very deep and unusual mutation of that particular strain that they had. Don't forget, friends, that a virus is much the same as anything else or anyone else. If you look at human beings en masse, you would not think in terms of how it is that so many different kinds of mutations, changes in pigment, coloration of hair, just the way a person looks, or the size of them, the shape of them, all of these factors are made and played into the concepts of mutation. So many in such a small space of time. And yet within this particular virus, there are still very small mutations which are happening, which mean that for some people, the mutation that they gather to themselves just happens to be a fatal one for them. Doesn't mean to say that same mutation would make it fatal to everyone else.
Hmm. Okay, well, if anybody would like to ask Gregory a question on this subject or any other subject, then the phone lines are open. We'd love to hear from you. The number is a free phone in the US. It's 877-876-5227. In Canada, it's 888-815-9756. And international callers isn't toll-free, but it's 001-530-876-3222. I have some questions here that were sent in by email from Ruth. And she said that she's trying to understand the concept that we create our own reality and the mechanics of how this works exactly.
Yes.
Can you speak on this, giving examples and scenarios of how this works? She says, you know, is it all to do with thoughts or feelings or both? And that changing these in some way would change our expectations, our experiences, rather.
Yes.
She says, for example, if someone was in a state of worry and negativity, say, trying to pay the bills,
yes.
Would the thoughts and feelings of worry bring about a negative outcome? Would the opposite be the case and the bills get paid, for instance?
An interesting point, friend. And I understand there are many human beings on your side of life who would swear black as blue that the whole concept of this kind of formation of thought simply means the removal or the manipulation of negative energy and swapping it for positive energy. And then, therefore, surely it must have a positive effect. However, you are already in that premise, then, thinking that you are dictating the timeline, but the timeline must always exist upon your hesitant facts or upon the way in which you think it should work ordinarily. So then that means that after one day and the matter doesn't happen or resolve itself in a positive way, you would perhaps cry foul and say that the matter is purely subjugated to hearsay or heresy. The point is, if you place a very positive thought about yourself and you send it to the ether world and you keep doing that, it will have a bounteous effect. That's not saying when it will have a bounteous effect, but it will. Eventually. How you demand within your own timeline that this then becomes something which is positive and immediate is perhaps scaled up by the amount of your demands that you send out to the ether world. Well, you must respond to me, ether world, because I'm praying for this to come about. I must have a change in my life. Usually these changes are to do with financial well-being or whatever, or maybe it's to gain some other physical object. Or perhaps it's to do with the well-being of a loved one. That's just the same. So what are you doing? You're sending your love to the ether world. You're sending out your energy to the ether world and then expecting the inbound energy coming from that prayer or that thought or compromise, if you like, that it actually has a different energy to it. So then there it is. You begin to feel much better about yourself because of what you've already done. But does that mean that it necessarily does get done? It's simply a matter of opinion and dependent upon how that thought is received by the spirit world and if it is replied to. Just because you send it out doesn't mean to say that it always will be. It will be tried so that the situation would be trite of me if I did not say, well, obviously it's going to be dealt with. However, the point is that some issues that are created from physical mass reality are simply not compatible with, not the world order, but not compatible perhaps with other minds, other thinking, other different resolutions of power against your power. So, for example, when you think that you are sending a prayer for peace towards some warring faction, or maybe within any other situation of your own country, or perhaps some other country. Maybe it's that you're sending prayers out to various different disinterested parties who are trying to obliterate the world into terrorism. So you're sending your loving thoughts out to this group or that group, whoever they may be. And then are aghast at the very fact that they've gone and bombed somewhere else on the planet's surface and blown up another 9, 10 or 90 people and sent their lives to the spirit world. Then perhaps you would think, well, then my intention isn't clear. I have failed. And then you would follow the road of deep negativity and despondency, feeling in fact that you had not managed it. Your fault or the spirit world's fault? God's fault, perhaps. This means then that your energy that you're sending out now in hindsight is a lot different to the one that you were praying for to find resolution. So instead what you should be doing is not succumbing to the negative energy because the negative energy won in your eyes. Therefore, your prayer was pointless and thoughtless and fruitless. But it wasn't. Because what happened was that your prayer, your loving energy, helped someone in the spirit world. Your prayer, your loving energy, even though it was for the bringing of peace, may not necessarily change the minds of those who are creating war. It may take something else completely differently, and not for you to send prayers of peace to them, but to physically stop them from creating the havoc that they want to bring through their lack of respect of life and their own ideals and opinions high held within themselves that they are right and the rest of the world is wrong, or the other people that they are, so say, against at that time. These are private personal decisions of one individual journeying through the physical life process, having their say, having their field of understanding. And no amount of prayer that you're going to make to them is going to make any difference. So does that mean to say your prayers are useless and are failing? No. In exactly the same, and I dare say, friend, that we've heard this all before, that I have to cite again that the Amish children, the 10 Amish children who passed to our side of life, the eldest one who said to her would-be executioner, "Take me first, please, so that I can show the other children no fear." And that's exactly what he did. So did that mean to say that child asked for her life to be taken? Of course not, not really. She was in total fear of herself. But what she feared most was how that would be represented into children much younger than herself. And so that they would not be frightened in their moments of passing, that she vowed that she would go first so that she would be able to protect them once they too transition to the spirit world. This then was an act of complete courage and an act of deep discompassion from the person who took her life. The reason why I cite this is purely and simply because thoughts are living things, and yet if you send a thought out to the ether world and you want for loving companionship, shall we say, you want a relationship. And instead of turning life upon its head and thinking that this is going to be one for you, purely and simply by sending out a prayer to the ether world, what you actually need to do is to go out and reinvent yourself. What you really need to do is not ask the spirit world for help and service and advice, but what you really need to do is look at yourself. Why am I not appealing to someone else? Why can I not change my life when I think and feel in this way? Simply, my dear friend, the answer is change your attitude. Change the way that you think then. Because maybe that is something which is not allowing you to display the flower that you are, that you truly are. If thoughts are living things, yes they are. Then it means to say all thoughts come from the initiate of your understanding of how you wish to make a description, how you come to decision and judgment. Sometimes human beings in physical life are subject to somebody else's thoughts, so no matter how much you pray for a different outcome, it will be against you, purely and simply because their power, their energy is against you and overpowers you. That's exactly what happens in slavery and exactly what happens at moments and times of panic and fear when a person takes another person's life.
The thing is, you can be very positive and send out positive thoughts and think positive, but unfortunately, if you are, say, living in a family that is very negative, then that will really have a counter... It would be counterproductive, won't it?
Yes, it will be counterproductive, and what we would say in that instance is move from the family.
Yes, I mean, I think that is the point, that we have to, yes, you do generate things of positivity, maybe not immediately, like Gregory said, when you do have positive thoughts, feelings and that sort of thing, but you have to be rational about things like that, you know.
Yes, quite so, and take responsibility.
Yes, and the people that you have around you, the people that you mix with, you know, your closest friends, you know, it all goes into the big pot. And, you know, if they are very negative, you know, if you're with people that are very negative all of the time, then, you know, sometimes that can be quite pointless, I'm afraid.
That is very true.
Yeah, makes it even more difficult.
Yes, and so what you have to do is extricate yourself from that environment.
Yes, well, people say, well, you know, they're my friends, I have to help them. And that's the other thing, that you have to be discerning about that too.
Yes.
How much you can help.
Yes.
And how much this person wants to help themselves. And
absolutely.
And that sort of thing, really.
Yes.
Isn't it?
Is that person completely disabled? If that's the case, then obviously, yes, you do want to help them. But for many people, they choose to disagree. They choose to be negative.
Mm-hmm.
Or they choose this or choose that. Maybe because it suits them, because it fits their purpose.
Well,
maybe because they are at a disadvantage at this present time and cannot see the true beauty of which they are a part and desire, truthfully.
Well, we've talked of this before, but it's always very fascinating, isn't it? Because it can become like a drug. Some people, you know, you're frightened to say, well, how are you? You know, because you know you're going to get a
story.
A torrent of,
yes.
Well, you know. And that's lovely, you know. I mean, if you can help this person, yes, listen and try to help. But sometimes it's just for the sake of it. And it's like a drug. It's like a drug effect, isn't it?
But it's
because
simply...
They don't realise they like it, but is it like a soporific effect?
Yes, that's true. And, of course, it creates a chemistry within the physical body system that person becomes dependent upon, which is why it is irrationally that people sink into the mire of thought and preservation, not of themselves, but woe is me, and all of the different things that they could do or see other people doing, which they feel a complete lack of involvement over, purely and simply because they think they're unworthy of it, or they simply cannot do it. How do they know they cannot do it if they haven't tried?
Well, so how do you, everybody knows somebody like this, at least one person.
I'm sure.
So how do you actually, this is the hardest thing, how do you actually approach this subject with them to explain to them how their thinking, positive thinking will change their life and that they are doing this? Because it's a very delicate thing to say, well, you know, you're not slamming their character or anything like that, you're trying to help. But for a start, they might not think that they need help or want help, and they might be affronted by you saying that they are like that. I mean, that's very difficult. It's really difficult to help show somebody that they are like that, even as a reflection so that they can maybe think about it and help themselves.
Yes, I understand. I completely concur with that. But I have to say, as a human physical being and either as a spirit being, we have all to, in a sense, indicate our responsibility towards someone else and perhaps when it's at an appropriate time, voice that opinion, not necessarily in a very direct and abusive way, obviously not, but certainly in a way perhaps that person may be able to tolerate and take within themselves.
Hmm. It's usually very difficult because very often it's this person will cite other people. It's always as somebody else's fault why they are feeling like they are, why they have all these problems and etc. It's hardly ever their fault.
Yes, it's part of the situation of medicinal care in any event. And the whole realm of how it is that you as a person who becomes a patient, shall we say, through some event, or however that is initiated, whether it's catastrophic or not, the degree of the event will obviously reflect upon the severity of the cause and the resulting injury created to you. And this is exactly the same, my dear friends, whether it's a physical violence of one form or another, either another physical being or a blunt object or something like that. You walk into a tree. Who put that tree there? Well, actually, it was been there a long time. But it's not an excuse, is it? You then perhaps see that the human being themselves feels partly foolish for actually walking into the tree and not seeing it when it's perfectly clear to everyone else. The other situation, of course, is that if you then cross the road and that you didn't see the vehicle that was coming. My typical case, of course, being decapitated after having a coach and four horses run over me was a case in point, I suppose. I didn't see it coming, didn't hear it, didn't feel it. Suddenly I was knocked flat by horses. The next moment I was passed. And there is not any situation that I blame the people who were driving the horses and carriage at the time. Nor am I blaming myself, in a sense. Because it was simply what happened. So I suppose the whole situation around this then meant that I did not attach blame. Therefore, I didn't blame myself either. Because I didn't attach any blame to myself. So therefore, I, when I passed, wasn't negative. I was very positive. And plainly speaking so. Now, the situation that tends to happen in many other degrees of cases will be that a person perhaps who had been steering the vehicle previously, if it was a hot sunny day or something like that, or the conditions were totally different to my own case, it would have meant that the way that the manner of their passing perhaps might not have been that much of an accident. Perhaps it was due to lack of care and attention or some other thing. How much then you apportion blame, or perhaps in the case of, shall we say, a person who has caught a disease, or maybe they had an injury sustained to them but wasn't life-threatening, but nonetheless altered their life. How are you then, as a physical being, going to carry on with the carriage of your life? Are you going to constantly blame the other person? and also blame yourself for still being in pain. Part of one of the conditions that we talk about often is really to do with pain management and how it is that a human being may oftentimes continue in the throes of pain when in actual fact the actual cause and seat of pain had already passed. But what simply happens is that due to the person's proximity of mind control or the event horizon that they see but cannot see is a life without pain. So it means that the patient then will constantly presume upon the doctor to get them out of pain. You owe me this. You have this ability, therefore do something for me, is what the client, patient, will want their doctor to do. Take me out of this pain. Cure this dis-ease. Where in actual fact, for many of the situations, you can bring about this whole merry-go-round to halt yourself. And how you do this is, first of all, you make a decision, and talking about then sufferers in chronic situations, bless you, friend. Are we done now? You want to
have a drink of water?
Have a little drink of water, friend. So then you have a situation of people who are suffering in chronic situations where the sight of pain perhaps was something that was dealt with years ago. And that actually shall we say that the scarred tissue once developed, then may even give its own pain for a few years, and therefore then you have to have pain medication for that pain, and then that eventually subsides, but the pain's still there, purely and simply because the pain gate's still left open. And that is a symptomatic situation. It's also partly physical and also partly mental. So it's not a psychotic problem. It's a psychological problem that the person has to re-evaluate themselves and move away from the position that they adopt. The doctor has to help me. So part of what you have to do as a physical being in understanding this relationship is that you say to yourself, the doctor can no longer help me with this pain that I have. If it's a chronic site situation, oftentimes it can be relieved by certain kinds of understanding to do with management of the mind. And this means then that, in truth, it brings to the whole focus of what we're talking about. That thought is a living thing. So therefore, if you take your thought that you are in pain, and that's a constant oppression, maybe it's a cyclical pain, something that you experience when you wake up first thing in the morning, and it's worse then. And then at certain times of the day, it goes off completely. It's either a simple indication that you need to do more exercise in order to gain the muscle groups so that your carriage is held differently, so that it's held away from the site of pain. It may well be that instead of medication, what you need to do is practice a different form of meditation, which is part of the reason why we say that safety meditation is really the cure for anything, purely and simply because it's a way of bringing the mind under your control. And instead of allowing it to control itself and to control you. Part of the pain gate theory and practice that we advocate is in fact to do with this kind of mind management that enables you as a sufferer, a client, to rise up from the sea gates of pain, if you like, that have been left open from sites of injury, from many different sites of situation perhaps to do with the actual flesh being mended or something like that, operation sites and that kind of thing, are often a common cause of it. And then simply by utilizing the actual mind, this is in a sense the other side of the coin, that you are able then to become pain-free. This means that mind is truly over matter, and that many people's situations in chronic disorder tend to come about and arise through lack of interest, through lack of ability or awareness that you are indeed the master of your own being.
Okay, well, Ruth says, do we create all of our reality, every aspect, health, abundance, happiness, peace, and relationships, etc.?
No.
I would love to feel I'm not a victim of circumstance and fate, and that I have the power within me to be ecstatically happy.
Absolutely. Of course, you do have the power in you to be ecstatically happy, even in the face of absolute adversity. You may be someone who was clapped into prison. I'm not saying that you are, my dear friend Ruth. However, for some people, that's where they find themselves. How are they going to distill their inner sight into something of beauty when all they see are four ugly walls and ugly relationships with other ugly-minded people? They're not going to find much happiness there. There is a great deal of negativity and distress over living in that kind of condition.
I think that's the idea, though, isn't it?
That is very true. However, the point is, this does not mean to say that you are ever going to turn these people into fulfilling, obligated citizens. If that is all that you do, subject them into some kind of disorder or their own private hell, I suppose. The point is, I understand that many situations of justice want an eye for an eye. And it doesn't necessarily mean to say it's going to resolve matters into creating better people. Part of what happens in societies are that it creates people of intensive negativity because for one reason or another they cannot obtain the things they are thought to suppose to have. Therefore, they become obdurate, violent. They become unnecessary, they become fractured from the society in which they live.
Yes, but they obviously get a certain amount of pleasure from
the violence they create.
Yes, a different set of chemical reactions within their bodily system than other people.
That is very true. I completely concur, dear friend Little Bird, that many people are actually subjugated to certain kinds of intensity, just like being, shall we say, addicted to a drug or something like that, they become addicted to violence. It's just another form of addiction.
Well, very often it's revenge in their eyes a lot of the time. So, but nevertheless, there is the sensations and the feelings that they get from that.
Yes, absolutely so. Yes, and of course it's part of the reason why some people turn to violence is simply because they don't have a role model to tell them not to.
Hmm.
Which is a society-led division.
Mm. Okay. Yeah. So, let me see. All right, yes, I have a question here from...
I believe that was something on there, friend.
What?
Do you need to turn the status into away?
Oh, right.
Yes.
Yeah.
You can do that?
I don't think so, no. I'll try. But anyway, I have a question here from Rosanna. When somebody repeatedly shows up late or is inconsiderate of others and you discuss this behaviour with another, is this considered criticism or judgment or an observation of somebody else's behaviour?
Well, that depends upon the energy with which you give it, my dear friend Rosanna. So the point is, I suppose, if the person consequently always turns up late, why don't you simply do something else about it? So give them a different time. If they are always going to be turning up 10 minutes or 30 minutes late or something like that, then tell them to be there by that time earlier, and then they won't be late.
Well, I think there's probably more to it than that. I think the idea.
I do too. I'm just playing with you.
I think it's the worrying about whether it's criticism or judgment or an observation when in talking about somebody else's behaviour that, that obviously doesn't sit well with them.
I understand that.
And it's an interesting point, actually.
It is a very interesting point, friend. I'm merely saying, though, that that is a potential way of, in observation, that you may then make to find out if this actually throws any light upon the person themselves. So it's quite a kind way, in a sense, rather than being dismissive or perhaps saying to the person's face, you're late again, and then creating intensive negativity from that reaction may not necessarily have the dramatic effect you desire, because they might say so. And the point is then, well, why do you want to be late? Why do you want to make me angry or not come to the agreed time? It may well be that some people, when they react in this way, simply don't organize themselves sufficiently to be able to do that. They may have come to the decision themselves, the late person, that they are always late simply because they never get it together, or because they are always simply late.
And, yes,
well,
time.
You know me,
there's
I'm always
time.
Late.
Yes.
So,
okay.
But at the other time, I'm saying and suggesting here that the fact that people then become angry is immaterial. That's your reaction to them being late because you think they care less about you, or the necessity for that you place upon the importance of it, that they don't have the same importance of it. Does that mean to say you're not communicating with them? Your level of importance is somehow brushed aside by this other person's concept of their own reality and the very fact that, yes, of course I'm late. I'm always late for everything. It may well be as innocent as that, and that that is the way that they argue their point, and can be actually quite shocked of the fact that you are so disorientated by their apparent lateness, when in actual fact it's part of their currency trait of dealing with their side of life, with your side of life. Now, for other people, they do it purely because they have other interests. Therefore, the importance that they have over the date that you have made with them is not as important as the territory with which you have planned it. This means to say your lack of communication has brought about this disinterest on their part and the apparent annoyance on your part. So what I'm saying, friend, is simply that the thing to do will be either make it that you accept that they're always going to be late, or that you make them, or you tell them a different time to the time perhaps that you're going to tell everyone else. Maybe you're meeting in a group or something like that, and you want to go out and go to some party or something, or maybe you've got to go to a meeting or to see a film or whatever it is. Then tell that person to be early. But don't say that. Simply say a different time.
Yeah.
And then they'll turn up at the right time. But they'll think that they're still late. Many people in that way simply might not be able to handle the precepts of time. It might be because all of the things that they have to do in order for them to be ready is that they simply can't manage it, and they're not good time managers. Some people orientate their lives not within the strict framework of time. I am well aware that you live in the product of time, linear time, one and one. So it means to say that everything that you do, feel, sense and orientate with is fixated by the time state. Breathe. Take care.
Okay, well, thank you, Gregory. Fascinating as usual.
Well, very well. With love and light then, my dear friend. God bless. God bless everyone upon your beautiful journeys. Make them beautiful if they are not.
We'll try. And we hope you've enjoyed the show. I'd just like to mention our website again, which is www.spirit-teaching.com, where you can find out plenty more information about us, or maybe book yourself as an Akashic reading. And just like to say thank you so much for listening. My name is Sylvie Avery, and you've been listening to Spirit's Work. And until next time, be peaceful, be positive, and focused on your goal, knowing you're not alone in trying to create a better world. Goodbye.